What I'm going to do now is take you through the text. Some of it I'm going to put there and explain. Some of it I'm just going to read it to you, just so that we've heard it all, but not all of it needs a lot of explanation because we've done a fair bit already. So let's begin. The first words of the Ecclesiastes read, "The words of Kohelet, the son of David, the king in Jerusalem." They call that a superscription, which really just means a little title on the top that the editors have put in. Why they've chosen that is obvious, because in chapter 1, verse 12, which we'll read shortly, the main character on the stage says, "I am Kohelet, I have been a king over Israel in Jerusalem." And I explained to you last week, the name Solomon never appears explicitly, but clearly that's what they've got in mind, because here, at the beginning of Proverbs, it reads, "The Proverbs of Solomon, son of David, king of Israel." The Song of Songs begins, "The Song of Songs, which is Solomon's." And in the light of Kohelet, which I explained last week, is the preacher, the man of the assembly, but it's a feminine form, which I won't go into again with you, but tried to touch last week. In the book of Kings, the first book, chapter 8, we read, "Solomon stood before the altar of Yahweh in the presence of all the assembly, the Kahal of Israel, and spread out his hands to heaven." A good image for you to have as the backdrop of the stage, to see Solomon all through this book there, talking to the assembly now, centuries later, in the light of what's actually happened in the history, and questioning everything, his wisdom, his wealth, his power, etc. So we're looking, and we'll look at the first half of the day, at part one, accepting the gift of God is what I have called it. And it begins, "Vanity of vanities," says Kohelet, "vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What do people gain in all the toil at which they labour under the sun?" That's the whole of this book. And I've mentioned there the word for vanity we did last week, hebel. It occurs 27 times in the book. Toil occurs 35 times, and under the sun occurs 29 times in just a few chapters. So he's picked up the main themes at the beginning. The image of hebel, vanity, is of a mist that suddenly vanishes, a passing breath, a fleeting shadow. The eye catches a glimpse of something, but it's gone. We hear something, but as soon as we pay attention, there's nothing there, silence. We're startled. Time doesn't stand still. Everything that exists under the sun is constantly changing, but ultimately achieves nothing new. Things lack substance, says our author. Our efforts to understand anything are doomed to futility. If we look to anything under the sun to find meaning in our lives, we lack wisdom. All is vanity. What do people gain in all the toil that they labour under the sun? My comment on it, people work hard to achieve something. People work hard to understand. We're working hard to understand. But ultimately, what's the point, he's saying? What is there to show for all the toil that Solomon laboured at? The Jerusalem temple of the 4th century BC had been rebuilt out of the rubble left over from Solomon's glorious temple, which was destroyed at the beginning of the 6th century. The fortified cities of the northern and southern kingdoms are no more. If this is true for Solomon, it's surely true for the rest of us. Vanity of vanities is the Hebrew superlative. He's saying that everything under the sun is supremely in vain, going nowhere, to no end, to no purpose. I'll read you from Psalm 39 now. Yahweh, says the psalmist, let me know my end. What is the meaning, the measure of my days? Let me know how fleeting my life is. You've made my days a few hand breadths. My lifetime is as nothing in your sight. Surely everyone stands as a mere, and here it is again, chebel, a mere. Surely everyone goes about like a shadow. Surely for nothing they are in turmoil. They heap up and don't know who will gather. So Coelho's not the only one. We all reflect like this at times, I imagine. Here's another psalm, Psalm 62. Those of low estate are but a hebel, a breath. Those of high estate are a delusion. In the balance as they go up, they're gathered, they're together, lighter than a hebel. Because this is the way things are, everything we or others do or think is hebel, vanity, in vain. Nothing under the sun can satisfy the longings of our heart or our yearning for meaning. And keep watching, nothing under the sun, because there's something that isn't under the sun, and that's Yahweh. So now I'll just read to you, without putting it all up there, don't need that, I hope. I'll read to you from verses 4 to 13. You just enjoy it, or ponder it, or disagree with it, or reflect on it. A generation goes, a generation comes, but the world remains forever the same. The sun rises, the sun goes down, and then hurries to the place where it rises. They imagined the earth as the centre and the sun would go in the west and then it would be taken by chariots back to the east so that it could start again. That's how else could they imagine it? The wind blows to the south, it goes round to the north, round and round goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. All the streams run to the sea, but the sea isn't full. To the place where the streams flow, there they go again. All words are wearying. No one's able to speak. The eye isn't satisfied with seeing. The ear with hearing. What has been happening is what will happen. And what has been done is what will be done. There's nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it can be said, see, this is new? It's already been in the ages before us. The people who came before, they're not remembered. It'll be the same for those yet to come. There'll be no remembrance of them among those who come after. I am Kohelet. See, this is, you watch Solomon in the center stage reflecting on wisdom. I'm Kohelet. I've been a king over Israel in Jerusalem. I applied my mind to seek and search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It's an unhappy business that God has given to human beings to busy themselves with. And then verse 14, I observed all the deeds that have been done under the sun, and look, all is vanity, a chasing after wind. An expression that occurs 9 times through this. And he goes on, what is crooked cannot be made straight. What is lacking can't be counted. I said to my heart, I've acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me. And my mind has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. And yet, when I applied my mind to know wisdom and knowledge, madness and prudence, I perceive that this too is but a chasing after wind. And something you wouldn't pick up in English, and a lot of the translations haven't picked it up. The word for prudence in Hebrew is siklut. Siklut. And that's a practical virtue that guides us in what we should do. In Hebrew, if you replace the initial consonant, which is called a sin, a sik, with a samek, which is also an S sound, but a different consonant, they sound practically the same. Matter of fact, I don't know what the difference is in sound, and no one can tell me, because how do you know how people pronounce things so long ago? But basically, siklut can mean prudence. Siklut, with a different S, means folly. So there's a lot of that in this. It's Hebrew, but it's playing with words, as you'd expect in a poem. And we can't pick that up in English. We just translate it as best we can and miss a lot of the music of it. But as he says he's trying to distinguish between madness and prudence. But it sounds like madness and folly. And in fact, it's translated that way in many translations. But it's all, he says, a chasing after wind. What is crooked, he says, cannot be made straight. Oh, I've just done that. No. What is crooked cannot be made straight. I don't know where I am. Did I read that first? In the abundance of wisdom, it says, is much vexation. Those who increase knowledge increase sorrow. I said to my heart, come now, I'll get you to experience pleasure. This reminded me of John Keats's poem. I think it's the Grecian Urn, I think, or the Grecian. It's very like it. I said to my heart, come now, I'll get you to experience pleasure. Enjoy yourself. Maybe there's meaning in that. But again, this was all in vain. I said of laughter, what's the point? And of pleasure, what use is it? I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine. Maybe that's the solution. Huh? My heart was still guiding me with wisdom. I was not led along by folly. I wanted to see what was good for human beings to do under heaven during the few days of their life. I achieved great deeds. I built houses. I planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks. The word for park is paradis, from which we get paradise. So I made these wonderful parks, and you've seen plenty of them, and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. I acquired male and female slaves, and had slaves who were born to my house. I also possessed great herds and flocks, more than any who'd been before me in Jerusalem. I also accumulated for myself silver and gold and the treasures of kings and provinces. I got singers, men and women, and delights of the flesh with many concubines. So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem, and my wisdom aided me. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I didn't keep my heart from any pleasure, and my heart found pleasure in all my work, and this was my portion for all my toil. Then I reflected on all that my hands had done and the toil I'd spent doing it, and again, all was vanity, but chasing after wind. There was nothing to be gained under the sun. So I turned to consider wisdom and inane folly. For what can the one do who comes after the king? Only what has already been done. I observed that wisdom excels folly, so he's not against wisdom, it's better. It excels it as light excels darkness. The wise have eyes in their head, fools walk in darkness. But I know that the same fate befalls all of them. And we did that last week. Death is the end of life for him, so ultimately it's all pointless. Then I said to my heart, what happens to the fool is going to happen to me too. Why then have I been determined to be so very wise? And I said to my heart, this too is in vain, for there's no enduring remembrance of the wise or of fools, seeing that in the days to come all will have long been forgotten. How the wise die just like fools. So I hated life, because what is done under the sun brings grief to me. It's vanity, it's a chasing after wind. I hated what I gained from all my toil in which I toiled under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to those who come after me, and who knows whether they will be wise or foolish. Yes, they'll be master of all for which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This too is vanity. So I turned to rid my heart of illusions concerning all the toil of my labours under the sun, because sometimes one who's toiled for wisdom, knowledge, and achievement must leave all to be enjoyed by another who didn't toil for it. This also is an absurdity. It's in vain, it's vanity, and a great evil. What do human beings get from all their toil and pursuit of their heart at which they toil under the sun? For all their days are full of pain, their work is a vexation, even at night their hearts find no rest. This also is vanity. Now look at his conclusion to all of this pretty grey, grim stuff. There's nothing better for people to do but for them to eat and drink and see their toil as good. I saw that this too is from the hand of God. For who will eat and who will worry except as God determines? Last week, really important. Everything that happens in this life is determined by God, according to his understanding, eh? So with that understanding, if you get a bit of good luck, God organised it, so go for it. If you get bad one, well, God organised too much, you can't do much about it, so take it. Cop it on the chin. But don't, you know, grab what you can out of life, because God's organising the good for you as well. As God gives him, determines. For to one who pleases him, God gives wisdom and knowledge and pleasure. While to one who misses out, and the Hebrew for missing out is hote, the hata is the verb, and it means missing the mark. And it's translated in the Greek as hamartia, which is missing the mark, which is sin. So the one who misses out, sins, misses the mark, all kind of efforts to describe, to say in words. But it's interesting that the Hebrew is Greek and Hebrew are identical using that image. That's why we say we are all sinners. Now, it doesn't mean we set out to sin. Sometimes we might do that. And if we do, well, we've got to take the guilt of that and the responsibility and learn from it. But most of us, most of the time, are sinning without knowing. You know what, aren't we? I mean, we end up hurting people. We didn't intend to hurt them, and we didn't even know they were hurt. But they were hurt, and we did it. We missed the mark. Do you get it? We tried, perhaps. Maybe did our best, but it didn't work. And it might be because they've got the problem. It might have been other. So we've got to be very careful about this word sin, but we've got to admit that we're not walking a perfect path. And in this world, I'm getting a bit carried away now, but we do hurt and we do things that are wrong and we do stumble, don't we? And we do all those things. And we don't want to take the whole responsibility on us, and that's why the church has this wonderful doctrine, which is constantly misunderstood, called original sin. It's a sin of our origins. So a lot of our missing the mark is because our mum and dad missed the mark a bit. And they missed the mark because their parents missed the mark. And they had an Uncle Jack who was a bloody whatever. Or they went and listened to sermons by people like me and got it all wrong. So they missed the mark, do you know? They missed the mark in their marriage because they took advice from someone who didn't know the slightest thing about it. And so it goes on. Like, he's talking about, this is our life. This is what human life's like. So when we actually take responsibility, we've got to be very clear that we don't overtake responsibility for what we're not responsible for. But we can still apologise and we can still learn. You follow me in all that, don't you? But the word itself picks that up, I think. The one who misses out, he gives the work of gathering and collecting, only to give to one who pleases God. This is all vanity and a chasing after. The only wisdom, he's telling us, worthy of the name, is when God gives you pleasure, grab it and enjoy the moment. Get all the joy out of it that you can. And I don't know that that's easy to do, but it's not bad advice. I wish I could do it, do you know? Because sometimes, you know, we're all different, but sometimes for me, you kind of remember what happened and you're sorry that happened. And you're so sorry that happened that it's spoiling the moment now. You're not actually living it. You're not allowing forgiveness to come, perhaps not even forgiving yourself properly. Or you're so worried about tomorrow that you're not here now. You know, hello, I'm here. So, and that spoils the moment too. So we're all a bit like this, depending on our temperament. And he's telling us, if God gives you a moment of joy, because that's all there is. And then he goes straight on to something we all know very well. There's a time for everything, a moment and a time for every matter under heaven. Now, if anyone had their guitar here, you could actually sing it for us. Who wrote that? A time for... Seekers, wasn't it? Anyhow, Seekers, Peter, Paul, Mary, somebody like that. Here it is, and I won't try and sing it for you.
The birds.
A time, did you? Someone say, did they?
The birds.
A time for giving birth, a time for dying. A time for planting, a time for uprooting what has been planted. A time for killing, a time for healing, a time for knocking down, and a time for building up. A time for weeping. A time for laughter, a time for mourning and a time for dancing, a time for throwing stones away and a time for gathering stones, a time for embracing, a time for refraining from embracing. There's a time for searching and a time for giving up the search, a time for keeping, a time for throwing out. A time for tearing and a time for sewing up. A time for being silent and a time for speaking. a time for loving, a time for hating, a time for war, and a time for peace. What return has a worker for all his toil? And then I'll read you the next couple of verses. I've seen the business that God has given to everyone to occupy themselves with. He's made everything suitable for its time. He has put the desire for eternity in the human heart. Yet human beings will not discover what it is that God has done from the beginning to the end. Pretty important statement, especially if any of us, you're probably not, but if any of us attempted to think we know God's will, like with absolute certainty, if anyone ever tells you they know God's will with absolute certainty, it's actually fairly easy to relate to them because you know they're wrong. I mean, you know, like, you know, well, you let that go because nobody can be. Can we be? I mean, God is God, for heaven's sake. God's will is inspiring everyone in the world. So you'd have to know everything, and every movement of the soul to know the breath of God and which direction the breath is. It doesn't mean we're completely not knowledgeless, but it does mean we're pretty humble and we do our best and we're always looking and ready to be corrected and ready to change if evidence points somewhere else. And that's how I live, that's how you live, that's how I've got to live. And it's an okay way to live because it's real. We're walking in the grey, aren't we? Not too much black and white. And if you're living in a black and white world, get help. I know, he says. He said this before, so let's look at it. Chapter 3. I know there's nothing good for them except to be happy and enjoy themselves as long as they live. Moreover, all people should eat and drink and take pleasure in their toil. That is the gift of God. So it's not all negative, is it? It's pretty. He's taking away everything that you can't rely on. And he doesn't know Jesus, so he doesn't know a lot of the things that we've been privileged to know. But granted all that, he knows what he knows, and I think it's pretty good. And he doesn't know much else, but he gets back to that all the time. It continues, and I'll read. I know that whatever God makes happen will occur. See, I've got major problems with that theologically. I suppose I hope you do too, because it would wasn't a shower something that God planned to get back at the Jews for the way they ran all the banks of Europe. Do you know what I mean? Is that? Of course not. Is God the one who's organising the greed in many parts of the world that are causing the economic troubles that we've got now? No. We've learned through Jesus that God weeps over the city. He doesn't run in and control it. We've learned that God is loving and has left us free. And we know that the world itself is free and emerging and with all these random energies that are at play, which makes us really careful. I think really careful about finding security in miracles too quickly. You know, miracles happening all the time. Wherever you love, a miracle is happening. That's the main miracle. And out of love, anything can flow because it's all coming from God. But if we're waiting for God to intervene in the world and change the wind into a rainy day or get rid of the rain so my daughter can have a good wedding, well, you're spoiling the wedding day, aren't you? Because I've done hundreds of weddings and I've done them in all kinds of weather. And if people enjoy it, it's always good. So why don't we just get on with life and whatever. So I'll let him speak and let me keep quiet. I know that whatever God makes happen will always occur. Nothing can be added to it and nothing can be taken away. God has done it so that all should stand in awe before him. Whatever happens already has happened, and whatever is to happen has happened already. And God will seek that which is pursued. Moreover, I've seen under the sun that in the place of justice there was wickedness, and in the place of righteousness there was wickedness. I said in my heart, God will judge the righteous and the wicked, for he's appointed a time for every matter and every activity. I said in my heart, as regards human beings, God has surely chosen to show that they are but animals, for the fate of humans and the fate of animals is all the same. As one dies, so dies the other. They all have the same breath, and humans have no advantage over the animals. It's all vanity. All go to one place. All are from the dust. All return to the dust. Who knows whether the human spirit goes upward or the spirit of animals goes downward to the earth? I saw that there is nothing better than that people should take pleasure in their activities, for that is their lot. He is at it again. And I'm repeating now from what he said earlier, just to show it to you, back in chapter 2, verse 24. There's nothing better for human beings than to eat and drink, find enjoyment in their toil. This also, I saw, is from the hand of God. And he continues. Are you managing this all right? Moreover, I saw all the oppressions that occur under the sun. Look, the tears of the oppressed with no one to comfort them. Their oppressors wield the power and they have no one to comfort them. I reckon the dead who have already died more fortunate than the living who are still alive. But better than both is the one who never existed, who has not seen the evil deeds that are done under the sun. We lived in a pretty typical world for our world. Violence, war, random destruction of life, etc. I saw that all toil and all achievement comes from one person's envy of another. This also is vanity of chasing after the wind. Fools sit on their hands and consume their own flesh. Better one handful with quiet than two handfuls with toil and a chasing after the wind. Instead of you having to mow the lawn for five of your houses, wouldn't it be good to just mow it for one and actually settle down, have a bit of whiskey before you go to bed? Just settle a bit. That's not out of Ecclesiastes. I saw something else, he says, that doesn't make sense under the sun. The case of solitary individuals without children or siblings. There's no end to all their toil, yet their eyes are never satisfied with their possessions. Who am I toiling for, they ask, and depriving myself of pleasure? This also is vanity, an unhappy business. Two are better than one, he says, because they have a good outcome for their toil. For if either of them should fall, the other will lift them up. But woe to the one who is alone and falls and doesn't have anyone to help. It's an argument against celibacy. This is better even. If two lie together, they keep warm. How can one keep warm on his own? Well, it's starting to get interesting. Though one might be overpowered, he says, two together may resist. Then he puts in another argument. A three-ply cord isn't easily broken. So, yeah, it's better to be with someone than be on your own. He agrees with that. And if another thing that's better is a young person who is a commoner but wise than an old person, a king who's foolish, who no longer knows how to take advice. Oh dear. One can come out of prison to reign. Maybe he knew this in his own environment because they moved. One can come out of prison to reign, while another, though born into kingship, is impoverished. This is poverty to riches stuff, eh? I saw all the living who, moving about under the sun, follow that youth who replaced the king, the crowd. Ryan, Ryan. Look what they're doing all over the world, cheering the next dictator. There is no limit to the multitude, to all before whom he appears, this upstart. Though those who come later won't be happy in him. Surely this also is vanity, a chasing after wind.